We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Actor, writer and comedian Jimmy Mulville got his first taste of entertainment in the infamous Cambridge Footlights while studying French and classics at Jesus's College. It was here he met fellow comedian Rory McGrath, which led to the creation of the heavyweight production company Hat Trick in 1986, which was responsible for the creation of defining shows such as Drop the Dead Donkey, Harry Enfield's television programme and Game On. As an actor, he starred in the ITV sitcom That's Love in the 1980s, alongside Diana Hardcastle and Tony Slattery. I caught up with the renowned comedy heavyweight to talk heroes, TV production and laughter. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jimmy Mulville.
So let's go back to the beginning. Like so many of Britain's best-loved performers, Cleese, Palin, Cook and Fry, you possibly got your first taste of entertainment in the Cambridge Footlights. Always cited as an important step to success, why do you think this was so important to the development of British comedy?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't put myself in the same bracket as those guys, but I hear what you're saying is that it was an amazing place because I got to Cambridge in my first year, didn't do a lot of performing. I wanted to. I auditioned for a couple of Footlight shows and didn't really get anywhere. But then I did a play which the president of Footlight saw and liked my performance and said, oh, do you want to come along? We're having a meeting. And so it's in my second year, really, I got in with a gang of people and I got introduced to a young man called Rory McGrath, and he and I hit it off and we kind of wrote things together. Rory was a great writer and I used to help him out, really. I used to do the typing. And then bit by bit, we found that we were becoming more central to the Footlights Club. And in my final year, I became the president of Footlights. And so Rory and I basically, you know, we ran the club for that final year in 1977. And the review of that year was quite successful. It was directed and produced by Griff Rhys-Jones, who had just left. He just left and was heading off to the BBC to become a producer. But he did a really good review for us. And it landed on BBC TV. And then we went to the Edinburgh Festival, successful there. And then I came back thinking that, you know, well, I was in the Footlights and it's all going to be plain sailing. But I left university without any job, and I didn't want to get a job in a bank or as an accountant or any of those kind of jobs. I wanted to become an actor or a writer or, you know, in that world, but I didn't know how to get into it. And there's no kind of linear, you know, you don't go for a series of interviews and they pick one to become an actor. It's like it's a very non-linear world. So my first job was in Catford in South London as a porter in Lewisham Hospital. And there I was there for about eight months. And then I got a letter from a man called Ian Davidson, who was a script editor at the BBC. And he said he'd seen me in the Edinburgh Festival in the Footlights Review. He liked what I'd done and would I come for a meeting with him at the BBC, which was amazing because I just thought, I'm going to the BBC. And I went to see an edition of The Two Ronnies. He was script editing The Two Ronnies. And I saw and I met, you know, The Two Ronnies in the bar. And it was just that proximity to the world I wanted to be in was so exciting. Yeah. And he gave me a commission, Ian, to write some material. And I then contacted Andy Hamilton, because I knew Andy was a very good writer and was beginning to write for the radio. So he and I and Rory did some writing. It didn't really get anywhere except the fact it gave me a taste of the kind of life that I wanted. And then jumped to a night. I'd gone to see one of Griff Rhys-Jones' radio shows in the bar afterwards, I had a bit of an argument with this old bloke. I say old, he was probably about 40. And but he seemed old to me. I was 20, 22, 23. And I hadn't liked the show particularly. And I was telling him why I didn't like the show. And he was arguing with me. And the following day, I went to meet Griff at the BBC for lunch. And this guy popped out of an office. And I didn't know that this guy was, in fact, Griff Rhys-Jones' boss, a man called David Hatch, with whom I'd picked the fight the night before in the bar after three beers. And he said, do you want to come and have a chat? So I went in thinking he was going to bollock me and say, you know, get out of my office. But he said, I was very interested in what you were saying last night. He said, you had a lot to say for yourself. He said, I've got these bursaries for writers in the radio comedy department. One of them's gone to Guy Jenkin. One of them's gone to Rory McGrath. And I was wondering whether you wanted the third one. Now, I'd never seen myself as being a writer, pure and simple, but it was certainly in the... I certainly wanted to be in the BBC more than I wanted to be a porter in Lewisham Hospital. Nothing against that, by the way, but I didn't want to be in that. That wasn't my world, you know?
Yep.
So suddenly I find myself with a radio contract. So the answer to your question is Footlights got me going in the world that I wanted to be in. And I had to keep up with my university work to stay there, but I sacrificed getting a good degree in order to do well in the Footlights, because I knew my future would lie in that world and not in the world of, you know, reading ancient Greek and Latin, which is what I was doing as a subject. So it was quite an exciting time to meet other people who wanted to do what I wanted to do. And that's one of the good things about college and university is, you know, you can start to meet people who are young adults who have the same aspirations and visions that you have. So it kind of makes your own dreams and aspirations not as ludicrous as you may have thought they were.
Josh just said, and also it's obviously quite a good thing, quite prestigious to follow in those footsteps, people like Tim Brooke Taylor and...
Yes. No, it's actually, you know, you're right, Josh, but also it does create for a young person a sense of something to live up to, you know? So it's a gift and a curse, because very often you do a show and the review would say, I just seen the current Footlight show. Is there another John Cleese in this cast? I don't think there is. You know, you get those kind of reviews. In fact, Clive Anderson, who was the Footlights president when I was in my first year, he directed a Footlights review, and he got together brilliantly in the program. He put together all the reviews from all the newspaper reviews of all the Footlight shows, and each year. For example, the year that John Cleese was in the Footlights Review, Bernard Levin, who's a very famous journalist, said, the question on people's minds when they look at the Footlights is there another Peter Cook? Because Peter Cook had been Footlights in 1959. Mm. And the short answer is no. Mr. Cleese, a very tall, lanky, gangling performer, apparently is studying law. I urge him to continue with the law and give up performing immediately. So, you know, being compared to people who've already made it when you're still new and you're building, you know, you're trying to build your career, in one way you get attention because people want to see what the current Footlights is doing, but very often you'll get compared unfavorably with these great stars of comedy who've spent years, you know, honing their craft.
So nowadays it seems that almost every creative entertainment type attempts to take ownership over their work, and occasionally others too. Yet in 1986, with the exception of David Frost years previous, you became one of very few performers to own your own production house, Hat Trick Productions.
Yeah.
As you already mentioned. What was it about the entertainment landscape during the mid-80s which made you want to take full control over the content that you were creating?
That's a really great question, because it puts it, you put your finger on a turning point in the history of the television and entertainment business, when the then Conservative government, as you know, headed up by Margaret Thatcher, decided to disrupt the TV community by saying, we're going to create a channel called Channel 4, and they will take all independent production. They won't produce any programs themselves. And ITV and BBC, you will have to take 25% of your output from independents and not from in-house production teams. So what that does immediately, it creates a market, because now you've got Channel 4 who'll buy 100% from the independent sector, and then you've got the two big, the duopoly of ITV and BBC, who were forced by law to take 50% between them of independent production. So now you create a demand, and there weren't many independent production companies around. In the mid-80s, there were very few. And we were actually making a show called Who Dares Wins. We were acting and writing in a show called Who Dares Wins, which was being made by a company called Holmes Associates, run by a man called Andrew Holmes, very nice guy, who actually had made his name making kind of medical documentaries and factual programming. But my then girlfriend, Denise O'Donoghue, who later founded Hattrick with me, and we were later man and wife, she was a producer working in the company. And so we gave her this idea of Who Dares Wins. So she took it to Channel 4, and this unlikely producer, the medical program producer, started to produce a big entertainment show on late night on Channel 4. And after a couple of years, I remember saying to Denise, how does it work? How does the independent sector work? And she explained it really clearly and brilliantly, because she's a very smart person. She said, well, it's very simple. You create a budget, and the budget is a certain fixed figure. And in the budget, you build in a margin, a percentage of profit, which is what the producer takes. Then there is the overhead, which pays for your equipment and your desks and your rent. And then if you underspend, you can create more profit by sharing the underspend with the broadcaster. And I said, why don't we do this? Now, I didn't know how to do it. It just struck me that it was a good idea. And we didn't know anything. We were in our late 20s. We knew absolutely nothing, but we were brave, I suppose. And Denise and Rory McGrath and I, we set up a company, and Denise called it Hattrick, because Rory and I were big football fans. And she thought, Hattrick, it sounds successful. It's three goals. So it's kind of got a feeling of success about it. And it's sporty, and it has a ring to it. And we embarked on this, we didn't know. Rory and I wrote, the very first show was a sitcom called Chelmsford 123, which is set in ancient Britain. And our idea was to produce it ourselves. If it worked, it worked. If it didn't work, fine, we just go back to our day jobs of being writers and producers and actors. But it worked. They commissioned a second season. And then crucially and importantly, something really game-changing happened, is that I was asked to be in an episode of Whose Line Is It Anyway on the radio. It was a radio show, radio floor show. And I was in the show with Lenny Henry, Stephen Fry, and John Sessions, who sadly just recently passed away. And I was awful in it. I mean, I couldn't keep up with John and Stephen. They were just too quick and brilliant. But with my producer's hat on, I recognized what a brilliant show this was. And I said to the producer, have you thought of doing this on television? And he said, well, we have. In fact, we've given it to the BBC TV entertainment department, and they've been sitting on it for 6 months. And I said, well, they're useless. And they were, in the 80s, the entertainment department was very antiquated. It was still, you know, hooked on Jim Davison and people like that. Mm. And so the idea of giving a show to a bunch of young tearaways wouldn't have been on their radar. So I got Channel 4 to come down to see the radio show the following week. And of course, I don't know whether you've seen Who's Line on television, but it looks pretty much like it looked on the radio. It's Clive Anderson and four people standing behind microphones improvising. And Channel 4 commissioned a series of 12 episodes that year. And that show was our first hit. And that show changed the course of the company's history, really, because once you have a hit show that keeps coming back year in, year out, year in, year out, and we added to that a year later, we added Have I Got News For You, which then again became a hit show year in. Then when you've got these repeated series, you can build a company because you have these building blocks where you have a certainty over your income, which means you can spend that income on developing new ideas. So it becomes a virtuous circle. So we were really lucky that we had, out of our first three shows, two of them were big raging hits, which became a staple diet on Channel 4 and on BBC Two. And then the 90s opened up for us very nicely with Clive Anderson Talk Show, followed by Drop the Donkey, then Father Ted. And, you know, we had a very good run for our money in the 1990s.
Yeah. Josh said, how do you think Whose Line Is It Anyway changed the format for the panel show? Because before that, they were all quite formal. And how do you think it sort of changed that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of brought it into the modern age a bit, didn't it? Because it wasn't as stiff. I mean, up until that point, you know, BBC panel shows, people wore suits and kind of maybe they were a bit older. This was a pretty young cast. You know, these were all young performers with edge, and they were improvising, so it had a kind of an adrenaline feel to it. And I think, you know, then with Have I Got News For You, and then they think it's all over as well with sport, and then never mind the Buzzcocks. You know, these panel shows suddenly became really popular, but they weren't being populated by stiff middle-aged people. They were being run by younger people in their late 20s, early 30s. And they felt as though they were at the kind of edge of things rather than being in the middle of the bed. They were at the edge, you know?
Yeah. Don Ward's Comedy Store is always cited as the birthplace of alternative comedy. How important do you think that was in giving your generation a platform to hone your craft? And what impact did the Comedy Store have on the early output of Hattrick?
Well, it's interesting. The Comedy Store, there were different schools of comedy in the 80s. And I think that the Comedy Store had a particular style. Remember, Clive and I did a 5-minute act on his first night. And I never went back. I was too frightened. And Clive did go back. He was a much better stand-up comedian than I was. And I think that out of it came, you know, Alexis Sale. And I mean, Rick Mail and Aid were already doing their own thing. They were, you know, they were doing, and Dawn and Jennifer, these were already people who were coming through. But the Comedy Store was, again, it was an expression of almost like punk comedy. So you had these people who would just get up, and if they were good enough, they wouldn't get gonged off. And if they were, Alexi thought they were shit, they'd get gonged off. So it was a kind of quite a tough environment. And we had, when we were all working in BBC Radio in the late 70s, we decided to book every month, we book the room above the pub, the Horse and Groom on Great Portland Street. And we'd invite people to come and do their act. So we had Alexi coming, Rick came, a few other people came. So it was already, there were these green shoots in the late 70s, early 80s, that were poking up. Because you had a whole generation of young comedy performers that wanted a place to express themselves. I mean, now, of course, you can go onto YouTube, you can create your own YouTube channel, and it's great. You know, you can actually have your own, you can broadcast your own material without asking the permission of somebody who's twice your age who doesn't get what you're doing. And I suppose that was our version of the internet, were these pubs and clubs that we could just stand up and do sketches, do stand up without anybody telling us what to do. You know, it was a kind of a way to explore what you wanted to say. And then bit by bit, I think, you know, you had the Young Ones, we did Who Dares Wins. You had Alexi Sale, did his show on TV. French and Saunders started doing their thing. So that you suddenly see, and then in the end, it took over BBC Entertainment and became an entertainment, and it became the establishment. So by the 90s, these were all Lenny Henry, were all established comedians. They were no longer on the fringes. They were dominating, and they pushed out the old-fashioned, you know, rather old-fashioned comedians who were still telling mother-in-law jokes, suddenly felt very, very old and tired and not what people wanted to watch on TV.
Yeah. As an actor, you starred in the ITV sitcom That's Love, alongside Tony Slattery and Diana Hardcastle. Almost forgotten about in today's disposable TV landscape, but how did this provide a grounding in TV comedy, which you then built upon in the years following?
I auditioned for that role. They called me in, and it was down to me, and there's another guy who was up for it too. It was a properly trained actor, and don't forget, I had no training. I auditioned with Diana, and we kind of got on very well. And I think what happened was they kind of saw there was a kind of chemistry between us. And interestingly, we did two pilots for that show because they couldn't work out whether it was a comedy that you could do in front of a live audience, or is a comedy that would actually be better if it was just single camera, because as it was written, there weren't any kind of jokes on the page. It was all in the characterization and in the situation that this couple found themselves, which I really liked. I thought the writing was great. It was written by a man called Terence Frisby, who'd written a very famous play called As the Girl in My Soup, which had been one of the huge hits of the 1960s. And he wrote very well for characters and for situations, and especially for married couples. He wrote a really good argument. You know, he could write really good arguments between a man and a wife, which fueled the show because they were always having an argument about something. And I learned a lot doing that because I'd never seen it. We'd done Chelmsford 1, 2, 3. So I guess I was learning the ropes there about how to do, you know, continuous narrative situation comedy. But this was for a mainstream audience. So in those days, if you did a show on ITV, you'd get 9 million people watching it. So it was the time of my life where I was the most recognized because people were watching this show and, you know, they stop you on the street. Mm-hmm. And I remember once in the show that the character I played, Donald, admitted he'd been unfaithful to his wife. So they go to counselling. They go and see Tony Slattery, who's the counsellor. Of course, he suggests that we move apart from each other. Then he starts dating the wife, the counsellor. So the whole thing kicks off. But I remember coming in from a holiday, and I was with Denise at the time, and we were coming out through customs and immigration, and where you get your bags. And this one said to me, "You should be ashamed of yourself the way you treat your wife." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, you know, the way she's so lovely, you know, and you've got a good job." And I thought, wow, she's confusing me with the person I play on TV, which that happens a lot to people who find themselves in popular TV shows. But it was a kind of odd moment. It was quite a surreal moment. As we can see that, you know, the current state of the world is that a lot of people believe what they're told, even if they're told the most outrageous things. But it's true. You know, look at Donald Trump.
In what ways do you think your performing route shaped you as a TV executive?
Well, I realised in my late 30s that I probably wasn't going to continue to be an actor the rest of my life, that I'd had a good time, but it was kind of time to do something else. And what I felt was that I had been a producer at BBC Radio for a couple of years and I enjoyed that. We'd set up Hattrick and there was plenty to do at Hattrick. So I figured that having been a performer and having been a writer, these things would help me when I was talking to performers and writers. And that's been the case, is I can empathize with a writer when I'm giving notes, and I can empathize with an actor when they've just given a performance. I know what it I know exactly what it feels like to hand in a script, and I know exactly what it feels like to have just finished a performance. I've had those experiences. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, has helped me as a producer, because I know what it feels like. I know how vulnerable people feel at certain moments.
Yeah. How has Hattrick exceeded your expectations, and what do you look for in a successful production now?
Well, Hattrick certainly exceeded my expectations. I thought it would last for 6 months, and it's lasted for 34 years, so which I find very hard to believe that I'm that old. And I think that it's provided me with, you know, with a very interesting job, a very good living. I've met some fantastically stimulating, bright, intelligent people. I've met some total assholes, not many at all, actually, to be honest, but a few. And all of them, actually, I found very interesting and challenging, and made my life, you know, a lot more exciting than it would have been had I not done this. Now, what was the second half of your question?
What do you look for in a successful production?
Yes. Well, I can see why I ignored that question, because it's so difficult. It's so difficult because you don't really know anything. I mean, I watched Derry Girls coming out of the edit suite, and I liked it. And I'm from Liverpool, so I kind of understood the accents, but I kept thinking, God, you know, I wonder if anyone can hang on, because the delivery is so quick and funny, but so quick. You know, will they get this in Berkshire or anywhere else apart from Ireland and maybe parts of Liverpool and the Northwest? Anyway, as you know, it was a big hit and everybody loved it. In fact, it's on Netflix. I get letters from America saying how much they love it in America, although I think some of them do watch it with subtitles. So I don't know what makes a great show. All I know is that when you see it, you know it. And you know, when I saw the first pilot of Outnumbered, I remember I was getting ready to go out, and I was putting my socks on, and I stopped putting my socks on. Well, I had one sock on. I was watching it on the telly in my room, and I just stayed in one position and watched the whole thing. And I thought, well, for it to stop me in my tracks, literally, that I couldn't put my second sock on, there must be something interesting about this show, you know. Of course, that became a big hit for us. But the I think I defy anybody who says, oh, they know a show is going to be a hit. I think what I look for is, do I enjoy it? Or do people I trust at Hattrick enjoy it? It might not be made for me and my demographic, but, you know, is there somebody at Hattrick who really believes? I think you've got to have a sense of belief in the show, because their TV shows are hard to make. The idea you make something that you don't like is insufferable, because in the end, you're meticulously planning a failure. You have to love the thing you're doing, because, you know, it is quite hard. And it's like anything, you know, like you do this, you know, you put this together. It's hard work, but it's worth doing. You know, these are things that are worth doing. And if you enjoy the journey of the doing enough, then you'll put up with all the crap that goes with it, because you like the outcome.
Yeah.
So I rely on my instincts a lot of the time when it comes to commissioning shows for Hattrick to develop. And I listen to other people at Hattrick who've got very good taste.
Fair enough. Josh says, just got a quick follow-on question to that.
Yeah.
Josh just said that as a writer himself, and we have this question a little bit from other people who are writers who listen, and when we've been on other shows and stuff, when writers submit work, what is it that for you is the thing where you find a writer that you want to work with, or accepting work from writers? And like from a writer's point of view, how do you sort of know which companies to send it to and stuff?
Well, I think if you're a new writer, or you're as yet unpublished writer, I think what's important is to look at programs that you like and find out who makes them. And then if you want to write shows like the shows they make, that's a good guide to the fact that if you write a script in the same area as one of their shows, they're going to feel kind of empathetic towards that. They're going to feel that, you know, there's no point sending in a heavy psychological drama to somebody who makes comedies, because they're not going to do that.
No.
So I think that as a broad rule is find out the shows you really like, find out who makes them, and send your ideas into them. And write ideas that you feel that you're confident about, you know, the world, you know, that you can be god of your own comedy world or your own dramatic world. So that often requires drawing on your own experience or doing a lot of research.
Yeah.
Or a combination of the two, really.
Yeah. Okay. Looking back now, how revolutionary was Drop the Dead Donkey in breaking down the fourth wall of comedy and attempting to merge sitcom with reality?
Well, Drop the Dead Donkey was unusual in as much as we recorded it on a Wednesday night and it went out on a Thursday night, because we used to drop into it very topical jokes. So we'd write a lot of, or Andy and Guy would write a lot of the show, like 80% of the show in advance. And then there'd be conversations between certain characters dotted throughout the show, which we'd leave blank. And that week we'd write them, Andy and Guy would write them. So it would be, because it was set in a newsroom, it was about the week's news, because that was their currency. They were putting out the news, so they'd have opinions about the news. So a couple of characters could be getting a coffee in the kitchen, and one of them would say, what are we going to do about the that Tony Blair story? I don't know, maybe joke. So it was a clever idea that it was like a sitcom, but we also dropped into it incredibly topical jokes. So it felt like it was a topical show as well as being a standard sitcom where characters had conflict in an office.
Yeah.
And of course, Andy and Guy then went on to do Ballot Monkeys, where before the election of 2014, where we had four campaign buses, Conservative, Labour, UKIP, Lib Dem, and we wrote some of the stuff in advance, but on the morning of the show going out, we recorded most of the show. We had four different casts on four buses, four directors, four editors, and they'd rehearse, shoot, edit the four different buses. Then the main editor would cut them all together. And that night, 12 hours later, at 10 o'clock at night on Channel 4, the show would go out. So you couldn't get a more topical sitcom than that, actually recorded on the day of the show.
Yeah.
And that was also very groundbreaking of Andy and Guy. They are superb kind of writers, but also they're very good at running a show.
Obviously, 2020 has been a trying year for everyone. In your opinion, how will the arts recover from COVID-19?
Well, I think that people are hungry to get back to people. As soon as the theatres can open, people will go back to the theatre. I really believe that, especially with the vaccine. And live events, I think, you know, studio sitcoms will fill up. We're doing Have I Got News For You now with a Zoom audience, not with a real audience. But that seems to work okay, because you don't see the audience when you're watching the show, you can hear them. And hearing people laughing at jokes generally is a good thing. So I think the arts are incredibly resilient. It's now they need support as they work through this difficult time without any revenues, is they need support, but they will bounce back. The people I know in the theatre, like Sonia Friedman, incredibly talented, hardworking, smart, resilient people. And I think within a matter of months, you'll hopefully have the West End filled up again with people going to the theatre, going to restaurants after the theatre. London's heart will start beating again. And I think that will be great.
Yeah. Looking back at your career, what is your proudest achievement?
My proudest achievement really is my family and my children. I think when I look at that, I think they're my best production. But I think if just specifically and narrowly, when I look at my overall kind of journey, I don't really see it as a career. I think career is a rather odd construction that people put on what they do during their day, because I've never seen any linear progression in my, it's like you join a bank as a junior teller and end up as a bank manager. I just do stuff that's in front of me and what takes my fancy, and I go off and do this and that doesn't work. I go off and do that. That works. So I like to have different challenges. Like, for example, we've just started a podcast business because I like the idea of somebody having an idea and then being able to do it the next week without having to go to a broadcaster, Netflix or a BBC, and asking for money. You can just do it. So the creative freedom of that is fantastic. So I like finding new things. I suppose one of my most challenging shows was the show called Episodes, which we did with Matt LeBlanc for BBC and Showtime. And I'd never done a show like that before, bringing together an American network and a British broadcaster. And that was very satisfying, you know, to do that. But in a way, all the shows that end up on TV with the Hattrick name on it, or now with the Hattrick Mercurio name, because I've just formed a company with Jeb Mercurio, and we're doing long-returning dramas. And Hattrick Mercurio is now an affiliated company with Hattrick, as with Livewire, we do live events, and Plum Pictures and Emporium. These are the affiliated companies. I'm proud of all the shows we do, because getting a show off the ground is really hard. And my definition of a hit show is actually when you do the first series and the broadcaster rings you up and says, can we have another series? For me, that's a hit show.
Yeah.
Because if you think about how many millions of ideas are pitched, how many thousands of those ideas that are put into development finally get onto the screen, and how many of those shows that get onto the screen last more than the first series, it's like a funnel. It's very few. So, you know, we've got a show called Dinner Date, which is on ITVB, which is it's a fun show, but very simple show. You know, it's a dating show and a cooking show, and it's been on the air for like 11 years. And, you know, it's probably not going to win as an Emmy Award or a BAFTA Award, but it's a hit show. It comes back year in, year out. It delights its audience. It satisfies its customer. And it makes us some profit, and we enjoy making it, and we have great people making it. So, and you set that alongside Have I Got News For You, which is 30 years old this year, has won all kinds of BAFTA awards. People have written about it, and I love that show too. And they're all like my children in a way, because I've seen how they were formed. You know, I've seen them all come into being from an idea, and land on the screen, and then people talk about them at dinner parties or on the bus or wherever they talk about them. That's great to see an idea go from someone's mouth in my office into someone's imagination in a cafe that I might be having a cup of coffee with, which happened to me 30 years ago. I was having a lunch in Soho, and I heard someone say on the table next to me, "Have you seen this new show, Whose Line Is It Anyway? It's absolutely brilliant." And I thought, oh my God, I think we may have a hit here because people are beginning to talk about our shows. So it's very hard for me to pick one show or one thing because, you know, it's all been such a rich experience, really.
Yeah. So lastly, what's next for Jimmy Mulville?
What's next? Well, we are at the moment we've pitched quite a few shows in America. So America, I've set my sights on, and we're in development with a couple of really, really good shows in America. And when we're out of lockdown and I can travel again to America, I'll be going out there and hopefully setting up a couple of big shows over there. And I'm not slowing down. I mean, I have no plans of giving it up or retiring or, you know, going on an allotment. I'm very happy doing what I'm doing. I think I'd shrivel up and die if I didn't do what I did, because I quite like being, I do miss being in the office, because we've now gone back into this second lockdown and we were going back into the office a few days a week, which I was really enjoying the mixed environment of, you know, Mondays at home, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in the office, really enjoying that. Now suddenly I'm in this room where you see me, and sometimes it feels like a bit like an open prison.
Yeah.
I'm exaggerating. You know, I can go and get a cup of tea and I can go for a walk with my dogs and things. But I do enjoy being with other people making things. I like the teamwork. That's what I like.
Excellent.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.